The list is in the open. Wake up, Claire. Jim's dead. They're dead. They're all dead.
Red light. Green light.
I'm saving it. I'm saving it. Why would I waste it?
Hey, first stop all, wasting dude. It. Stop
this
wasting
movie
it. You're
is
wasting
awesome,
it.
And I will have no dissenting opinion.
You're wasting the juice. Both of you are wasting the juice.
Look, we're gonna come back to that.
I'm recording
hour.
Right
well,
now.
Well, I'll do our.
I don't know if you guys are recording. I'm recording right now. This is usable juice from me.
Welcome back to Gentlemen Prefer Bonds. I'm Will Daniel.
And I'm Will Schlick.
And I'm Max Wilcox.
Tonight we're continuing our series of James Bond-inspired or adjacent material, discussing 1996's Mission Impossible. This is based on the TV show that ran from 1966 to 1973, created by Bruce Geller. This was Tom Cruise's first movie as a producer. He and Paula Wagner went to Paramount, told them they wanted to make a Mission Impossible movie, and if Tom Cruise told you he wanted to work with you in the mid-90s, you said, "How high, motherfucker?" Cruise hired Brian De Palma to direct. De Palma hired David Koepp, who'd written Carlito's Way for him a few years before that. Cruise didn't love that script, or in Cruise's words, the way he put it was, David Koepp wrote a great script, and then he had to go direct a movie, so Robert Towne came in to add some finishing touches. And the way Brian De Palma tells the story is, like, Cruise hated that script, he fired David Koepp, brought in Robert Towne to basically completely rewrite the whole thing. He said De Palma describes the movie as, like, the craziest movie he's worked on from a writer's perspective, where he eventually brought David Koepp back in, had both writers writing alternate versions or, like, conflicting scenes in different hotel rooms at the same time, said they were, you know, building sets with him having to go to Paramount all the time and, like, make sure that they'd be able to use those and shoot those scenes, that they weren't cut from the movie. Apparently, Bruce Geller, the TV show creator, comes in at some point, or I think it was the first day of filming, Brian De Palma goes up to him and is like, "Dude, like, thanks for creating this show. We all, like, owe you one. You should probably leave, though, because you're not going to like what we're doing on this. Like, I don't want to fight with you." So this movie comes out May 22nd, 1996. Had a budget of about $80 million, grossed $457. We all were five when this came out. I'm guessing you didn't see it in the theater. What was your first experience with Mission Impossible?
It was on TV a lot as I was a kid, and a movie I watched a lot of times. Probably not jumping the gun here, because I think we have a formal ranking coming later, but probably my favorite Cruise movie as a kid to watch. I always really, really loved it. It holds up is all I got to say, having not watched it for about 10 years now, maybe, or something.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed watching it this time, too. So
I saw two in theaters.
Yeah.
When it came out in 2000, when we were 10. Which is a more reasonable time to go see movies like this. This one, I can't tell you. It had to have just been, like, on TV or, like, a Blockbuster rental.
Yeah.
It rides that perfect wave of, like, very, very gruesome, but, like, without actually being gory.
It's a pretty hard PG-13, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They really, they stretch it in, a really cool, smart way for the time period. Granted, I mean, obviously we live in 2022 where, you know, like, this is hardly shit that would trouble someone on TV. But, like, in 96, this is like, this is stretching a PG-13 pretty far in an awesome way.
And for a movie with no sex, they're just, like, ramping up the thriller elements.
Yes.
Mentioned sex. There's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of Vin Rames, Jean Reno downtime.
Yeah, we don't see
obvious sexual tension on the train with them going on.
Yes. Yeah. There's the obvious sexual tension between Vin Rames and any piece of technology.
Yeah, who's got up?
Yeah, we don't see what Tom Cruise and Vanessa Redgrave do or don't get up to between the scenes, you know?
That woman, Jesus, I'd forgotten how hot she is in this. Oh, my God. Oh.
When she says she likes the anonymity of, like, going by a male name, and then she's like, she looks at Cruise and smiles, and she's like, it's like a, warm blanket.
Yeah, it's... I think, well, you said this, talking about it being a thriller. I think the most interesting thing for me re-watching it is that, yeah, this is not an action movie. The first Mission Impossible,
really
there's no... There's basically... What are the action
like,
set pieces
shoot,
in this?
There's like the end, the very ending.
The
set
very
piece.
End.
Yeah, that's an
yeah,
action.
Yeah, the very scene. End is an action set piece. But really, other than that, maybe the exploding fish tank and in this in Langley,
yeah,
like
that's
are
about
the.
It.
It's really not a. It's
well,
not
and then
an
there's the
movie.
There's the
it's,
beautifully. Yeah. I would call the so the most famous sequence, which I'm not going to talk about because we're gonna spend a decent amount of time, I would imagine, on it. I would weirdly call that a tantric. Like action sequence, if that makes sense. It's like if Sting directed an action sequence because it's all foreplay. That's what makes it so good. Because like I love the Italian Job, but none of it makes my dick hard like that scene does. I love the Italian Job.
Yeah, and this is, we've talked about before
it
how the story doesn't really make sense, and that's kind of my argument for Skyfall, and honestly a lot of the James Bond movies, is that I can't connect the A to B perfectly, or describe the logic of the story maybe, but I'm kind of there for the ride, and I'm not there so much for the connective tissue as I am for the Langley sequence and the opening assassination.
Go ahead. The A to B in this movie, having rewatched it just now and being fresh in my head, it makes a lot more sense as a plot than is... I think this movie is a little too disparaged for its lack of plot. Like, the plot is there if you watch it. And I watch it with subtitles and just was reading everything. Like, it makes general sense. Maybe...
Yeah. Let's go ahead for the... I don't know who you are. Hey, I don't know who you are. But if you're somehow listening to this and you have not seen Mission Impossible, firstly... How? Secondly, welcome. Mission Impossible, if I had to elevator pitch it, right? Tell me, jump in here if anyone, because I agree that I think the plot, while scarce, at least it semi-exists. Tom Cruise and his friends, who are all special agents, go on a mission to get a list of agent names. It turns out that they have been double-crossed twice, once by the CIA and once by a member within the team, and it turns out that was not the actual list. Tom Cruise, to find out who has double-crossed him, besides the CIA, because they're very open about it, decides to steal the actual list in an effort to then get the name of the person who double-crossed him via the person that was going to purchase the original list. That is the movie. And
that's the plot.
It's pretty straightforward, honestly. I don't think that it, like, there's not a lot there.
Yeah, how we get to certain places is confusing to me. But,
Via his many aliases.
Yeah, and also, yeah, just...
As the CIA says, he is a ghost. We trained him to be one.
Yeah. This movie can be summed up with one word. Computers. They were all
yeah,
on computers.
That's
like,
true. That's a valid
this
point.
This is right at the tech boom, and it's just like, hey, computers, you know?
So John Voight is Jim Phelps, who is the head of the IMF, correct?
No.
No,
John,
I think he's the head of his unit.
Oh, yes. Wait.
So he runs a unit out of, like,
so
Eastern Europe.
So is Kittredge the head of the IMF, or
no,
is he their, like, CIA?
Contact. I think that Kittredge is the liaison from IMF to CIA. So he's like he's not the boss, but he basically oversees that division.
Okay.
Like in this movie, correct me if I'm wrong, the IMF is a subsection of the CIA. They're the same entity and they operate.
They're American government. Yeah.
But IMF is folded into the, like, there's a lot of references to Langley and them being in there. So, like, they're a division of the CIA.
Yeah. I think it's
Kittredge, I think, runs that division of the CIA.
So Kittredge does run the IMF because, spoilers, he, and I'm actually weirdly very excited because I think that actor's really good in this role of just
Henry
sort of like
Zerny or whatever. Yeah.
He is coming back in the ones that are getting filmed right now as Kittredge, as the former head of the IMF.
That's I can't wait. He was just
I'm like legitimately excited about that.
Yeah, he was in that movie Ready or Not a couple years ago, and I was like, holy shit, I haven't seen this guy since like whichever came out last, this or I think this was just after Clear and Present Danger. That was the guy for 90s just office bureaucrat asshole.
He's actually kind of cool in this movie. He does a really good job.
It became like the bald Russian guy after that for the 2000s. Crap, what's his name? I love that actor. He's in Bruges as the guy who's like, you're smoking in the non-smoking section.
Oh, yeah, I know that guy.
Oh, Danny DeVito. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Go on with your daily lives and I will yell his name out when I Google it.
What spy movies is that guy in?
He plays the head of or an agent from the federal government in about 5 different TV shows and movies. Yeah. His name is Zelko Ivanik. He's also an astoundingly good Broadway actor. He was in the original Broadway production of The Pillow Man, as well as being in 3 Billboards because it was written by the same person.
Yeah.
And also being amazing in 7 Psychopaths. He's the guy that in 7 Psychopaths, he's the one that tells Christopher Walken, he's like, put your hands down. And he goes, no.
Yeah.
And he's like, why? And he's like, I don't want it. And he's like, but I have a gun. And he goes, who cares? It's like that brilliant, brilliant scene. But point is that he has played like the leader of the CIA in everything.
Starting in at the beginning, it's amazing how like quaint the cold open to this movie feels now, where it's just like Tom Cruise has a mask on. This is the only Mission Impossible movie where the actors are actually wearing real masks most of the time. With that, before it just becomes actors playing a character pretending to be themselves, I guess they've sedated Claire in some way that's dangerous, and have convinced this guy that
part's a little weird. Killed.
Yeah, it's a weird. We don't really know quite what the setup is there.
Yeah, it's a weird cold open, but it gets out of it quickly, so you don't really notice it that much, and you kind of just get onto the main plot.
I will also say that Emilio Estevez kind of sells it really well.
Yeah, he's good in this.
He's very good.
Yeah.
A great just Hall of Fame title sequence that becomes the model for all these movies of kind of is like the MTV era version of Goldfinger, where we're actually seeing tiny little previews of scenes from the movie, but it's for just half a second each, so we can't, you know, you don't get an idea of the structure of the story really, but really cool title sequence. And obviously I think maybe the best TV show theme of all time by Lalo Schifrin.
I don't know.
Big Bang Theory.
It's a really cool theme.
I think that it musically is the best, but like Friends, like is more well known.
Sure.
I
don't know. There haven't been Friends movies that have made like $800 million. I think
Friends.
I don't know. I think like random person in China might be more likely to recognize Mission Impossible.
I wouldn't
theme.
Call Friends though a theme song. That was a real song that those guys made that they used for that show.
That feels pedantic though, because it's not like. It when it was chosen as the theme song, people weren't like, oh yeah, the Beatles wrote this song and so we're gonna use it for fucking Friends.
No, I'm not saying that, but I think the Rembrandts were around, and I think that was just like a song, like nobody composed that for the show. It ended up working out really well, but I think the Rembrandts wrote that before it became the theme for Friends.
Happens a lot, but yeah. But if no one on earth except for maybe their mothers.
Yeah.
Would refer to it as anything but the Friends theme song.
At first, I thought you were going to say anybody but the Muppets were going to refer.
Only the Muppets.
They have strong opinions about TV.
I was just going to say that the theme song from the Muppets, the Muppets Tonight, is the best theme song.
Speaking of that, of themes and just scoring, Can we talk about how Danny Elfman just fucking kills it the whole movie?
I actually don't love this score.
I love this score. I love this score.
I like it.
Yeah, it's a little goofy. It's a little TV in places.
I know, that's what makes it so good. It makes you feel like you're like watching the TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so outrageous every time. Like, all the music, like Mission Impossible theme song aside, is so outrageous for every scene. You're just like, wow. Maybe I'm just a hardcore nut for like the Eric Serra, Danny Elfman 90s trend of like rock people doing theme songs.
It just, Lalo Schifrin, I think, is still alive today, or maybe he died a few years ago, but he was like, he scored like the Rush Hour movies after this, and those are pretty good scores, and I would rather have him do his own thing. But I think we're still in the era post Batman where it's like, no, get Danny Elfman to do your action movie.
I think Elfman kind of kills it, I gotta say. I could be the outlier, but
I like parts of it.
I really like it. I think it's fun and camp. I think that you watch it and it is one of those things where you're like, I know almost to the year when this took place. Like it is not, that is one of those movies that it happens in certain movies. I know for a fact that this is a mid 1990s movie from the music and the technology. Like, there's no other place in human history it could have taken place except for between 1994 and 1997.
Oh, especially when we go into the end, like, techno version of the Mission Impossible theme, and it just sounds like Mortal Kombat or something.
Yeah.
I like that. the stewardess, like, every stewardess on every airplane is apparently affiliated with the IMF, or just like they have the memo that, like, look, you might have a government agent on your plane, just encourage him to check out the cinema of the Ukraine and you're gonna have his mission on a little beta tape or something.
Beta tape, yeah.
it's this universe's version of like the hotel in John Wick, where it's like all flight attendants are neutral territory.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter if you're a Russian agent, if you're an American agent, they are there to like transport messages.
One thing that's cool about Brian De Palma and doing some research on this, he kind of shaped this movie more than I had imagined, because I would figure this is mostly Tom Cruise doing what he wants, but he never, I think, feels bound to source material, and he's always trying to just make the best movie version of something like he can. Like, watch the De Palma documentary recently, and he's talking about how, like, you know, TV versions are different versions of like Carrie after Do It Closer to the Book, and like, guess what? It's not as good. Like, it's not that cool to have Carrie's mom just like collapse and die of a heart attack. You know what's cool? Like, fucking flying knives to crucify someone, where it's like, you know, I'm sure the temptation was there to like say Jim Phelps is gonna be the, you know, the Obi-Wan, the M of this, but he's like, what if he's evil? Like, what if he turns and the guy you're expecting to be the mentor figure is evil? And what if we do? And he's always obviously ripping Hitchcock. But I think it was a cool idea. And he knew going into it that this kind of has to be the Tom Cruise show. This is Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible. So he's like, okay, let's just kill everyone else, including Kristin Scott Thomas, including Emilio Estevez. And as far as we know, at the beginning, John Voight, all die 20 minutes in. That's really cool.
It is really cool. That's got to be one of the more shocking intros ever to a movie. Because they're all big stars. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's the height of Emilio Estevez probably stardom. Yeah. That's coming off Mighty Ducks, is not that long before that. Kristin Scott Thomas, she's an English Patient that year and dies like early in the movie, which is crazy. It's a bold, bold movie. And you kind of forget that until you watch it and you're like, wow, this is a crazy movie.
Well, it's one of those things, we make fun of it now, but that Tom Cruise is an all-time lead man.
He is
a historic level. Like, that dude, like, one, just crazy handsome, crazy charismatic. Like, say whatever you want, and I do constantly about like the quote-unquote acting choices that he makes now and whatnot. But like, there was a 20-year period where the guy just couldn't do anything wrong. Like, he's so good. Oh, like, you have to watch him. He's insane.
No, I might just read later on, like, his IMDb from, like, 83 to, like, 2008. There's just a 25-year period.
It's insane.
Where, like, every other year, at least, there's a good movie. Pretty much every year, there's a movie that you've heard of or that made money or is iconic. Like, there's not... There's, you know, some misses in there, but, like, look at any actor's record for that long, and there's, like, so much more just embarrassing shit. And every one of these, you're like, oh, I've seen that on TV or something. Like,
counter to that, I looked this up today. So he makes Mission Impossible. It comes out in 96, and Jerry Maguire comes out in 96.
Yeah.
I don't think he's in another movie until 99, unless I'm wrong.
Until Eyes Wide Shut?
Eyes Wide Shut and
it could be.
Magnolia.
I think it averages out where he's like making one every year or two. If you like,
no, but
busy
he has like a 3 year break where he's not in that much stuff. He
might
be.
You're right. You're right.
Leo kind of does that now too, where he's like in 80 to 90% good movies, and he might just not be in a thing for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
But then it's a movie where he's the star. Jeez. That's like his project.
Tom Cruise takes a 3 year break, and then in the following 3 years, he goes Eyes Wide Shut, Mission Impossible 2, Vanilla Sky, Minority Report.
Yeah, but think about this.
That's
guy's
amazing.
At the peak. I would argue this is the peak of his stardom right now. In 96, he makes this and Jerry Maguire, which is unbelievable. He takes 3 years off.
Yeah.
I never really thought about it. I mean,
well,
yeah,
he had too many Thetans.
He had
all those. You know, he did those two movies, and that the camera shoots the Thetans at you.
Oh yeah, that's true. Well, there's all sorts of Thetan activity. He's probably reaching level 9 at this point or higher.
Yeah.
So,
I think Eyes Wide Shut took a while to come together as a project, also, and what an incredible run, because early 90s he's just got like A Few Good Men and like Interview with the Vampire
end.
Makes a lot of money.
That's the funny, like, he's a guy I don't really like him as an actor all that much, or I didn't when I was younger, because I always kind of thought he was like the antithesis of the cool actors like De Niro or Pacino or these guys that are really, he's just kind of run-of-the-mill action guy who's always about the glorification of him. I gotta tell you, in a retrospective, I still don't think he's a great actor. But damn, he is really, really prolific actor, and he's very, very cool.
He's our John Wayne of like he's gonna do variations on the same thing. But it's the thing that
perfect. Yes,
he knows that fucking works. He's our Cary Grant, you know.
Yeah, he is.
He
really is Cary.
Hold on.
Yeah,
I think Cary. Wait. I was fine with Captain Western, because he played the same character forever and did it really well one time, so he got an Oscar nom. An Oscar win?
Let's not
besmirch Cary Grant.
Okay, I love Cary Grant. I think
he plays the same role every time.
I think there's more range in what Cruise has done.
But that isn't the question. It is how good of an actor, because George Clooney plays George Clooney, but George Clooney is a better actor than Tom Cruise. Are you fucking me? Are you insane?
Have you seen the movie Collateral?
You think that
we're
going to
be talking about Collateral later.
Okay, yeah.
You think that Tom Cruise is on the same actor level? You're insane.
My argument is one word: Collateral. That's it.
Movie.
I mean, if you're gonna say like
Top Gun,
if you're gonna say we're gonna watch them play, you know, Macbeth back to back or something, it's maybe Clooney. But I'm thinking like the heights that they've reached in the movies that they've made. I put them next to each other.
You take the top five George Clooney movies and the top five Tom
performances
Cruise
movies. Or movies?
Performances, just performances. The fact that there was a silence followed by a well is ridiculous from the two of you.
I think you're can we talk about Rain Man for a minute? He's really good in Rain Man as a really young person, and he gives an extremely emotional performance in a really, really good. I think the idea that he's not as good of an actor as George Clooney is crazy. Has George Clooney ever played a real true villain for a whole movie? Because Tom Cruise pulled that off effortlessly in Collateral. And he is a bad guy.
That is not necessarily fair to call him a villain, because you are chosen to, you sympathize with him at certain points on purpose. He is an anti-hero and or a there's like a Greek term for it. He is not truly a villain.
He kind of is, and that's one thing.
The bad guy, but that doesn't mean that you don't that he is he's.
I'll throw out another one that no one will ever talk about: Tropic Thunder.
Hilarious, yeah.
No, I'm not going to make that a good performance. That is a caricature. What? It's fun and
he's
funny
as funny
and awesome.
As anyone else in that movie.
Yeah, but but I'm not. That is not. It is fun and it's funny, but that does not mean that it is a high level performance. He gets to get into a fat suit and yell motherfucker into a phone.
Throwing aside the Clooney comparison, I just. You said about the glorification of him, and I think the last 10 to 15 years have mostly been about what a good guy Tom Cruise / most of the time Ethan Hunt is, and like this is the moral backbone of America or whatever. But like, you go earlier on, he's really leaning into like the sleaze part of his charm at all, which really works in Rain Man, which really works in Jerry Maguire. Yeah. And he works in this.
He's not a great guy in this.
No, he's not. He tries to sleep with his partner's wife.
Most of the movie,
I think they do
constantly.
He literally just is like, okay, well, the good guys turned against me. I'm just gonna go like basically fleece and con the bad guys. So maybe I'll be fine after that.
Yeah,
he's kind of bad this whole movie.
But as an actor, as an entertainer in the 80s and 90s. You just see him, he's doing his Tom Cruise movies. He's got, you know, Mission Impossible, he's got Top Gun, which are his things, his movie star roles, but he's also seeking out these projects where he can work with esteemed, you know, legend directors and legend kind of mentor actors. He's trying to work with Dustin Hoffman, with Paul Newman, Scorsese, all these guys.
Right,
and
Robert Towne, you know, with Days of Thunder.
And that, I think that kind of stops around post-Tropic Thunder or post-Michael Mann, Steven Spielberg, where it's like, a certain point, 10 or 15 years ago, it's like, now I'm just making Tom Cruise movies, which is sad.
That's always what I hated about
that you're forgetting about Rock of Ages.
Okay.
His top performance.
There are always outliers.
Stacey Jacks in... Hey, one, I love Rock of Ages. I've seen it probably 5 or 6 times, and I have been nearly blackout drunk every time. And it is one of the funniest movies. I highly suggest drinking a little too much and turning on Rock of Ages. It is a good time.
So maybe a week ago, I put it on Hulu as I was going to bed, and at a certain point, I was like, Jesus Christ, this movie is long. Have I been watching this for... This has have been on for like half an hour, and I paused it. Rock of Ages had been on for 7 minutes. I was I don't think I'm making it to Tom Cruise. I don't think I can.
You weren't drunk. The first time I saw that, I was at the Landmark Theaters, rest in peace. And I had brought a 7-Eleven Big Gulp full of about a half a bottle of vodka. And it was like the couch seats upstairs. I laughed so hard that like a woman moved away from me.
There's not that far you can move away.
I cannot suggest it highly enough. Get just unreasonably drunk and watch Rock of Ages.
But I think part of this,
I'd have to be really drunk.
We're doing it. I'm flying out.
Okay,
some of the problems with his career in the last decade are not his fault, where it's just the landscape of movies, where it's like people kind of only want to see Iron Man or Mission Impossible in theaters now, where like you look at his past, his 80s and 90s, and it's like, holy shit, if you look at the numbers for these, when it's like, man, I miss the era where Jerry Maguire, Interview with a Vampire, The Firm, A Few Good Men Rain Man could come out and just make like $200 to $400 million. Like, that's insane.
He has an absolutely dominant streak, and he's made good stuff in this era. We'll talk about it a little bit later, but there's things he's done. But yeah, I think for me the real turning point with him is definitely
let's be honest. The turning point, because he also gets less opportunities post couch.
Yeah.
But Ghost Protocol I hated because it was the first movie, Mission Impossible. I loved Mission Impossible 3, actually, which I think came out in 2007.
I like 3.
Yeah.
3 is really, really good. That's J.J. Abrams. Abrams.
I liked Fallout a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I loved Mission Impossible 3. But at some point, there comes this time where I remember watching Ghost Protocol. We saw it in theaters, I think. You, me.
All three of us.
All three of us did, I think. Yeah. And I remember seeing it in theaters, and I'm just like, this movie is literally just sitting here to glorify Tom Cruise. Like, there's no plot. Yeah. There's no, like, villain. There's no. It's literally, like, how great can Tom Cruise be for 2.5 hours? And it was boring.
And it failed because of it. Well, we've talked about it failed for the same reasons why the modern Bonds do, which is that the Bourne Identity that beat them all.
Yep.
It's just that it did the formula better. It did the formula to a perfect T. And so in the most recent Mission Impossibles, they had to be like, well, shit, let's go back to our roots. Let's be a TV show. Let's be a massive set piece. Like, let's be a TV show if it had a $200 million budget.
Have you seen Ghost Protocol since it came out?
No. I might it better now.
Yeah, but I mean, we'll watch it again soon. I like that movie. But yeah, it's the couch happens, and then War of the Worlds comes out right after that, and Mission Impossible 3 is the next year. And those are really his big movies in the mid-2000s that are seen. They both made money, but they were both seen as having underperformed for what the expectations of a Cruise action movie would be. And yeah, he really doesn't come back. Yeah. I mean, I don't think Valkyrie made a ton of money. He's got a tiny role.
Nor did Night and Day. Jack Reacher did okay.
Yeah, so he comes back with Mission Impossible 4, which is meant to be, they're thinking about trying to slide him out of the series, and Jeremy Renner's in that movie to see if they can have him just star in the next one. And Tom Cruise is like, I think wisely at that point, doesn't fight the like, oh, you think I'm crazy? It's like, yeah, I'm crazy. I'll fucking climb on the outside of the tallest building for you. Yeah. Like, and it works. And that
made he has
a
that
ton of money.
He has that. And you know what comes out the year before that? Edge of Tomorrow.
No. That was later.
Yeah.
Edge of Tomorrow came out in 2014. I have it up on IMDb right now.
Ghost Protocol
is 2011, though.
You're talking about... Oh, thank you. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
I thought we were talking about Rogue Nation. My bad.
Yeah, Ghost Protocol is the fourth one, which is the one that kind of restarts his career a little.
Yeah.
And that was one I did not really particularly like.
Right.
And
but I'm just saying it makes a ton of money, and it reframes the series as like not only that it's going to be Tom Cruise, an action movie. It's going to be Tom Cruise, and he's going to do a couple of insane stunts for real.
Yep.
Yeah.
But to talk about Edge of Tomorrow, I love that movie. We saw that in theaters together, I think. And
yeah.
It's a real shame that movie didn't make more money and more people didn't see it, because it's really an unbelievable movie.
I really like it. I unfortunately saw it post-hype, so I already knew it was supposed to be really good, which means that I liked it. A lot of people loved it. I went in and I already expected it to be good, so I was like, yeah, it was a good movie.
Let's go back to the first Mission Impossible for a little bit. I'm just going through my notes here. It's a pretty corny dialogue where we kind of establish the camaraderie of the team in
the
hotel.
The coffee
bit, yeah. Oh, your wife's coffee sucks. Oh, like, what is this, a Folgers commercial from where it's like, oh yeah, Tom Cruise is still trying. He still smiles in this movie. Like, your wife's coffee sucks.
They're international spies that are going from country to country, and it's like, how often is she making coffee in, like, it's different brands, it's different machines, it can't just be her.
Well, it probably is her, because if she's the constant.
Wow.
Also, no one is suspicious or thinks it's weird that old ugly John Voight has a hot wife who's 25 years younger.
It's like, creepy.
That should be the first tip off that this guy's not legit.
Creepy. It's even weirder and creepier that she's like, there's never a twist. She is just in on it.
Yeah.
Like, it is so weird and creepy that she's just like, no, that's my husband and I love him. I love him so much that I pretended to love Tom Cruise more than I love my husband, John Voight.
Yeah, she's kind of a thing that breaks this movie a little, where you're like, what? That's her motivation, is she just likes John Voight that much?
Their chemistry is also not good, her and Tom Cruise.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, Tom Cruise should have had sex with Vanessa Redgrave in this movie. That should have been
bad,
it.
It's bad, man. Like,
but then
those weird moments, then they linger for so long on like the two or three different moments where they quote unquote almost get together. It's so bad.
Yeah. I think we assume they sleep together before the night before the train.
Yeah, probably.
But then her character, like, I don't know, because she's like, hey, let's not kill Ethan Hunt. Like, why does Jim Phelps shoot her instead of Ethan Hunt while he's getting out of the train? That makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, there's all sorts of that's what makes the plot bad of this movie. It's not that the plot doesn't make sense, it's just like nonsensical.
Yeah.
And
So also that the first scene they set up that they've put him up at the Drake Hotel in Chicago. Why does the fact that his wife have the Bible from the Drake Hotel let Tom Cruise know? Like, he knows that Jim Phelps is alive and evil, apparently, when he sees that book. Like, when he sees the Bible. I don't quite understand that.
Well, it has
because he was
the
supposed
Job,
to be
the
at
Job
the Drake alone. Would be one thing.
But why couldn't he have brought the Bible back and his wife had his things because he died?
No, that is the reason. He brought the Bible back because he needed it to be able to put in the correct... biblical verse.
Oh, for the
For Job 3:14.
Job 3:14, he had to be able to write down because the whole point is that it's assumed that he and Max constantly talk in biblical cipher,
right?
So like, and John Voight's like, I'm not memorizing this fucking thing, even though I'm a super spy. I'm just gonna steal this Bible from the Drake Hotel.
Okay, I guess that's
no. It's not clean. It is stupid, but it's the stupid. It's the stupidity of the character. Not like, I don't think it's a lazy. It is lazy in that the character as written wouldn't do that, but does make sense.
Max makes at one point when Tom Cruise first meets Max, she says like he kind of fucked everything up. Like he's apparently not that smart of a guy, because he was going to bring her a decrypted hard drive to get the knock list off. Like, he's an idiot, kind of. And Max suggests as much.
We've got our friend Andreas Wisnowski from Living Daylights and Die Hard as Max's bodyguard.
Yep. Zero lines in the movie.
Yeah, I think that's the one James Bond crossover cast wise, right? No one else. Like, and it's weird to me that at this point in time, like, Jean Reno or Kristen Scott Thomas haven't been in a Bond movie, because it's like, what are you doing? Like, we've got everyone else.
I love Jean Reno so much.
Yeah,
he is awesome in this movie. He's given awesome. Very little to do, but like every scene, he like completely steals. Like, I love him. I think he's so much fun. I love his weird knife. I googled it to try to buy it because it makes no sense. It was a prop.
It looks
that was
like
made
a
for the film.
It looks like the like Scream hunting knife or something.
Yeah,
but it's got like a computer handle, if that makes sense. It's like, give me the techno version of that.
The knife makes no sense. It's one of the reasons why I like it so much, because the handle is blocky, ill-shaped and inefficient and slick, which are all things that like a killer would not want. like the blade itself is curved towards the tip in a way that would make the knife break if you tried to stab anyone. The knife is ridiculous, and I fucking love it.
I think there's a suggestion a little bit that he's also just not that good because like he sneezes in the air vent and it's just like hey buddy like
and he like, doesn't care that the rope is like pulling and stuff. Well, I like that because he's a killer, not a
spy. Yeah, we see his sloppiness in that whole sequence, really.
Exactly,
just one difference you can say. Actually, at least the first, I think, four Mission Impossible movies are interesting, and you can hold them up against the first four Alien movies because you're telling the same story, the same kind of story, and just very different stylistic directors are taking each one and kind of doing their own thing. And, like, a difference between, at least stylistically, a very accomplished filmmaker like Brian De Palma and, you know, someone who had a little trouble, at least with his action movies here with number two, John Woo.
Yeah.
Fucking some of the best slow motion shots in any movie are in this one. The knife falling down. I wrote in my notes, Chekhov's Aquarium restaurant. That stuff is awesome. And yeah, I mean, I like the action stuff in Mission 2. It is like absurd though when you get into the doves and everything.
That's just John Woo being John Woo. This is some of the stuff in this that I my quote unquote notes is I just have a couple things. One of them is that the big beautiful knock drive, which is they pull out all the stops to do this thing that's like not quite a floppy disk, but not quite a USB. It's big, it's sexy, it's very techno, you know, futuristic, and you have it appear after Ving Rhames has just like done some techno babble bullshit that he clearly doesn't know what he's saying. They have that awesome scene where he's like, I need the QM53s with the incognito blah blah blahs. And it's like, all right, put on your hat and your glasses. But point being is that big sexy knock list, proudly stamped on it is that it is 230 megabytes because it is 1996, and that would be about the biggest sort of like piece of data that you could have. It is pretty freaking funny.
Computers are a little bit too much woven into the plot of this to their own detriment. It dates it a little bit, but I also find it funny that, and don't get me wrong, I think that the Langley break-in scene is one of the coolest action, or I would say like suspense scenes ever. It's unbelievable. It's absolute
tantric action.
Why is everything else in the room and encrypted in like a touch sense other than the computer?
Yes,
they can.
You mean like the floor?
A drop can fall on the floor.
A drop of water.
Yeah.
Because it's awesome.
He can type on the computer.
But he can just type on the
computer. What the key, if it was locked down, like, couldn't you have some sort of like key suppression?
And also, also the password is 6.
It's like 0-8. Letters. Yeah, 3-6.
Yeah.
But I
will say that guy, that employee is the single most dedicated employee I've ever seen in my entire life. That man is a superhero. If I threw up at work, I don't care where I work. I'm like, I'm going home.
Yeah.
I'm done. And then that guy, we watch him throw up at least 4 separate times, and he's like, gotta get back to work. gotta type in those numbers.
But I just love it. Like, everything in the room is all pressure sensitive. It's all based on around, like, if anything hits, you have an absolute pressure zone sitting there in what, like maybe 12-inch by 5-inch space. Just keys. Why don't you have an alarm on that? You could absolutely build one in there.
And I would also like to think, what I was thinking about the whole time is I was like, how much money did a set designer spend to design the cool fold-out, fold-in chair? Because it is a very cool chair, but like that feels like bespoke. That feels like something that the set designer was like, I need it to have this chair because the chair can't touch the floor, man. The chair's got to fold in and fold out.
Yeah, Roger Ebert says in his review, of course it's convenient that the decibel level is set high enough that it isn't triggered by the noise of a computer copying a disc, which is precisely what it should be guarding against.
but it's fucking cool.
Yeah, no.
I have to say, though, too, the greatest little suspense scene ever is when the guy walks in and Tom Cruise, he ropes back up and he's hanging there in the top.
It's so good.
The whole fact that this guy has a stomach ache and he has Tums in his bag and he throws the Tums in and he swallow it and he lifts his head up really briefly is like the coolest freaking suspense scene ever. And it happens in like a millisecond. Yeah. You're like, wow, that guy, but he just like looks up. Like, oh, he's going to find him.
Here's my even favorite part about it is that we know that he's been quote unquote poisoned with something like Ipecac, just something. We know that something has been put in, but this is a man who is so ready for something like that he brought an entire bottle of Tums to work on the reg, which for me, I was like, oh shit. Like as I was watching it and I was like, what if it doesn't work? What if this guy is so used to having like to having to shit himself that he's just like, I'll just take some Tums. And then you also have the most iconic part of that scene, which is the sweat droplet, which is just so good.
The whole design of the scene is Brian De Palma, and he came up with the sweat and all that. And it's I don't know if you've ever seen Rififi or Top Copy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jules Dassin movies from the 50s and 60s where Rififi, I think that there's kind of like a fireman's pole or something where they're coming in through like
a jewelry store
or something. Yeah. And then he does a more complicated version of his same sequence in Top Copy, which is what this is kind of based on, where a guy, it's like a, goes into a museum, I think, like hanging upside down. Yeah, I think the original version of this scene was just she comes in and is like, they got us lunch today. And she puts down a lot of Taco Bell and Arby's. And then he just gets that. And then he's just gone for like 2 hours.
Well, they should have me work in that facility. That was a scene.
It was a less suspenseful sequence because he doesn't come back.
Just the commitment of that dude. That dude is gone for like 4 minutes. He's like, I'm gonna go, I'm gonna throw up a casual 6-7 times, and then I will be back at my desk, don't you worry. And then here's the best part is we know that he sees the knife. He immediately then calls what's his IMF and has to then have a long lengthy meeting with him and probably a debrief. That dude is a rock star because all he wants to do is throw up again. Know it.
Yeah, he had a really uncomfortable long meeting with Kittredge that afternoon where he's just trying not to barf and Kittredge is cussing him out.
I watching this movie as an adult, all I could do is respect the work of that fucking 9-to-5 CIA dude.
Yeah.
He's also he asks the secretary lady if she wants anything. That dude's a superhero. And then a beautiful woman sits next to him, right next to him. Which doesn't happen in real life, and he doesn't hit on her. I'm in love with this man. This guy is an icon.
Yeah, also, he's pretty sure that she touches his shoulder, which he does, and he's not like, hey, how's it going?
Nothing! He does nothing! He's like, I'm married. Brenda and I are very happy.
He's a great guy.
I love this guy.
He definitely doesn't deserve to be manning the radar tower in Alaska, wherever he ends up. Like, that's one thing that the end of the movie, you know, Ethan Hunt's mom gets out of jail. Every wrong is righted. I think that guy's still stuck in Alaska. I don't think Kittredge thinks about unfucking that guy.
No way. No way in hell.
I guess because he still failed at his job, so. Ethan Hunt and his crew have to go rogue pretty much in every movie. Like, I think 2 and 6 are the ones where most of the time they're actually on a mission. Able to just score a fire truck, though. that was easy, apparently.
Yeah. Hey, he's got a lot of passports in that, right? He's got a lot of stuff there.
So many passports.
He's got his fireman's badge.
Yeah, he can do whatever he wants.
Borrow
as
a fire
concerned.
Truck pass.
They established that early that on. He's got everything he needs.
Well, that's the thing is they make a weirdly big part about him not having any money. But then money is never a problem throughout the entire heist, except for the fact that he has to quote unquote ask Max for money to do the heist. But like his go bag wasn't going to have $150,000 in it, which is what he asks Max for. So it's like, I get that that's what they're trying to set up, but like he wasn't going to be like, all right, I've got my couple of passports and I also have these Barabonds worth 50 mil. Like,
What's the deal? He goes back to the... He's got his, like, safe house hotel room place there. Why did Kittredge slash IMF not know about that place?
An excellent question. That is a good question.
Yeah, I was like, wait, is it safe to go there? Is it safe to be working all night on the computer there?
Especially given... Here's the even worse version of it, is that that is where they were all supposed to meet at, like, at 4 a.m. if the job... broke bad.
Yeah.
Love, by the way, that John Voight is like 4 a.m. 400, and I'm like, yeah, man, we're all spies. Fuck you. But you're right that either the IMF is gonna know where that is, or the IMF has just told Ethan that this was a mole hunt, and Ethan knows he's not the mole, so he just goes there to where assumedly the mole has to show up,
yeah.
And the first person to show up. He doesn't immediately shoot, and he should have, because it's what's her face, the wife.
It's shitty Claire.
Jim's dead, Claire.
Yeah, should we each do our cruise impressions again? Wake up, Claire! Jim's dead! They're all dead! Also, him on the phone with Kittredge. Yes. The list is in the open! Are you hearing me?
The opening title started to play, and I shouted red light, green light,
because
it is red light, green light at the end. That is an unnecessary secondary callback, but I love it so, so, so much. Just like watching him grip it and his red light, green light, slam on the glass. It's so good. It's so good.
It's like a James Bond joke that he's just making for himself. He's like, I remember this.
I do have to say, I think the thing I appreciate the most about this movie, having just rewatched it, you know, fairly recently, this is probably the closest we ever got to a Connery Bond movie. And from the standpoint that it really is a spy thriller.
In the 90s, you mean? Like,
I think maybe ever, in terms of like what they're trying to do. Like, sure. It's a movie. There's not a lot of action set pieces. It's people having conversations on trains and these weird spot and weird rooms and things like that. Like,
yeah.
If you watch this and really get it, it feels like Dr. No. It feels like From Russia with Love.
Yeah, it feels
a lot like From Russia with Love. And I think De Palma, I'm sure, watched those movies dozens of times. And this is the maybe feels the most to me of any movie. Like a Connery Bond movie. Mm-hmm. It's spycraft. Granted, not well done, but it's just
the way,
like
yeah, the way people that, having conversations. The way that Ethan Hunt talks to Max when he first meets her.
Yep.
Where like he's wearing the hood and he's like, why am I wearing the hood? And he's like, you, no one gets to talk to Max, otherwise they wear the hood forever. And he's just sort of like,
I don't talk well in shawl, or what does he say? In shrouds. Yeah.
In shrouds. Yeah. And then just like it comes off, and he immediately just like smiles that 1,000-watt smile. Very Connery.
Yeah.
So Robert Towne apparently was set on having the climax just be in the boxcar of the train. I assume Jim Phelps gets shot in there, and everyone takes a mask off by the end of it.
Sure.
Brian De Palma said he was fighting with him about that, and just gives up and is like, fine. Like, and Tom Cruise, he says, is like basically just standing there, and he's like, fine, let's do the boxcar. I love the boxcar. And then like the next day, Tom Cruise comes to him and is like, actually, maybe we can do that thing on top of the train. Like, that might mean, it's like, yeah, man, like people are expecting an action movie here. Like, that's
dude,
kind of the one action scene, which I think has not aged very well.
Yeah.
Especially compared to the movies now, but even compared, I think obviously the stunt, like tying a train, tying a helicopter on like a tiny cord to a train and having it go through that tunnel, not really something you can really do. But I think this suffers personally coming out a few years after like Terminator 2, which has like probably the best helicopter stunts of any movie, like going under the freeway bridges and stuff. To have this all be fake and just in the 90s blue screen doesn't hold up that great, especially when he's jumping onto the helicopter at the end.
Yeah, which is unfortunate, because it from a writing perspective, I think that it is one of the stronger parts, funnily enough, because it is my favorite. If it's Chekhov's giant glass restaurant, it's Chekhov's sarcastic Frenchman. Where Jean Reno, at the very beginning, when they tell him that they're going to break into Langley, he's like, "Oh, why don't you just give me a helicopter and I'll fly into Fort Knox and I'll fly right in the front doors." And then, even though he's been so bad at everything else, he does the impossible. Like, say what you want about his that asshole. Like, he flies the helicopter inside of the thing. Like, it sucks that you're right that it looks so bad, because the payoff is really cool. That then the reason why they don't get away is his own hubris at trying to kill Ethan. They crash because he tries to kill Ethan with the blades.
Right. I think in terms of like movie star charming Tom Cruise, it doesn't quite work for me. And like the first scene where it hasn't really been earned yet, and that bit's a little corny. I do like him with the like magic trick with the. When he's fucking with Jean Reno after that, like that's good shit. And then Ving Rhames like tries to do it himself also, like that's good stuff.
What does suck is when he throws the glasses at John Voight.
Yeah, it's like throws them. Yeah, nice man.
It's like, why didn't you keep them on? He's clearly gonna talk and say something incriminating. Like, instead he just kind of throws them and then keeps his hands up, like, don't shoot me.
Yeah, it's like,
cause he's his boss, you know. He loves him.
He loves him.
In the power of love, he'll make you throw glasses off your face.
Yeah, where it's like you could have been wearing the glasses that entire scene. He just puts them on, and it's like when John Voight isn't even saying anything, and it's like, this is the Mission Impossible world. Anyone can wear a mask that looks like anyone.
Yeah.
If you just see him, it's like, well, fuck, that could be Tom Cruise with a John Voight mask.
Yeah, you know how I know that could have been it? I know that it's possible because exactly 2.5 minutes ago, Tom Cruise was wearing a John Voight mask.
I'm glad, like, I think around 3 and 4, like, they're really overusing the mask thing. And I don't think they overplay it in this. I think considering, like, that was kind of the gimmick of the TV show, it's kind of fun in this movie. I don't think it's overdone.
No, I like it. It's used at the very beginning, and then they use it when you quote unquote least expect it. I think it's pretty clean.
So what's the most James Bond part of this movie?
That's a good question. There's a lot.
I think the gum gadget kind of makes me think of like the explosive like toothpaste in License to Kill. Like that's up there.
Yeah, I can't disagree.
What element would you take out of this movie and put in a pre-existing Bond movie or put in a new Bond movie?
Boy, if there's any element of this or of any Mission Impossible movie that I'd maybe take for a Bond movie, it was maybe him working a little bit more in the context of a team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool about this movie, the fact that he's sort of he's not just a lone wolf and is more associated with a team. In a fun way, but it feels, I mean, unlike No Time to Die, where it's just sort of like someone shows up later and like, oh, you got to work with this person or whatever. It's fun because from here on the onset, you feel like he's in a team, and I think it'd be fun. That's what I loved about Goldeneye.
You wouldn't want a whole movie of that, though.
It depends on how it was used. I mean, like Goldeneye was really cool because the opening is Bond and another guy, and it's like, oh wow, they're teammates. Like they're doing their thing together, you know. Maybe that, to see it one time, to see Bond in the context of a greater unit, could be fun. Or the exploding gun.
Yeah, I would like that. I like that. I would like a third act of a Bond film that takes place in a neutral location, as opposed to just another layer. Like this takes place. It is Spycraft. The third act takes place on a train, because as the characters say out loud, oh. An international train, no guns, no crowded area. Totally, this makes sense. This makes sense for Spycraft.
I'd also just like to point out Bond in the context of a team that actually does something, unlike the more recent Bond movies where there's just like an arbitrary team that's there to make jokes for Bond, like where it's
and
about
then die in really disappointing
Q
ways
having
that make
his
Max
cat
cry in the movie theater.
I feel like we could still get. I mean, in the 90s could have been cool. We could still get Kristen Scott Thomas in a Bond movie to do something, be a villain or play a kind of or get her. I think not really since Mathis have we had the kind of like older, like the kind of Karen Bay, like maybe underworld affiliated, like friend slash mentor to Bond, like. Yeah. Give me Kristen Scott Thomas for that in the new Bond movie. That'd be sweet.
She's great in this. And for really only being in it about 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
That opening.
So good in this. Yeah.
Yeah. That opening sequence is really a masterpiece. I mean, everyone's really good. They establish so much character with all those people. As corny as that scene is with the coffee and all that, like the rest of it is so good.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the opening at the like Prague party where then everyone gets killed.
No, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the coffees before that.
Okay,
But like when they're actually at the Prague party, it's very, very fun.
I texted I watched it last night, and I texted y'all while I was watching it, and I was like, the thing that feels really good and clean about this movie is that it feels like three episodes of a Mission Impossible TV reboot placed back to back to back to back. You have the Prague episode, which is an episode one that sets everything up and sets up his team, and then they die. And then you have an episode two that is him having to rebuild a team and going to Langley, and then you have an episode three that is on the train. Like, the act setup is so, so clean and so serialized that, like, it really works because you, especially when this came out, like, you know, the TV show ran 30 years before and they had tried a reboot in, like, the late 80s? But, like,
oh, I don't know.
That's what it was. It was a TV show about a group of spies that do heisty things. And like this movie knows exactly what it's supposed to do. And that's what makes it so good. And what I think makes it so rewatchable, because I agree. I hadn't watched this movie in probably 15 years, honestly.
Oh, wow.
And I should have. It's so good.
I think my main dig at the movie is if we're like separating into acts or episodes like that, I love Prague, I love Langley. I can live without the train. Like if I catch some of this on TV, I'm probably tapping out after CIA breakout. I don't need the train bit. Is only disappointing, I think, after the movie peaks really well twice or early.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah, I feel like the train wants something else before he gets to the final car. It wants something more dramatic than just Ving Rhames having his phone brought to him by a very nice attendant.
And nowadays, he would actually be on the train, and it would be sweet. But it's sort of a dated thing from then. But I will say, love that this movie is under 2 hours. I think when the credits roll, it's like 1:45 or something. Like, that'll never happen with an action movie again.
It feels so clean.
Yeah,
it does. And I will just say again, this movie is so cool because when you think about the Mission Impossible movies, you think about like action movies and just explosions and Tom Cruise running around. As much as Brian De Palma maybe didn't follow the traditional Mission Impossible show sense, like, this is a spy thriller.
He knew what a 90s Mission Impossible movie had to be.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this feels like a Mission Impossible movie where I would go as far as to say that all the other Mission Impossible movies feel like Tom Cruise movies that are action movies that are just using the Mission Impossible name, or like, this feels like a movie based on Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's got everything in there that makes it endeared to the show and all that. And I find it to be kind of an incredible movie. And maybe my favorite De Palma movie, if I'm being honest.
De Palma was also saying how, like, Tom Cruise was in like, outlining what he wanted for the movie. It was all United States, and he was like, Tom, like, it's Mission Impossible. Like, we're doing a huge spy movie. Let's go to, like, Europe. Like, let's use cool locations and let that be a part of it.
Yeah, it's also, like, just barely post-Cold War. Like, do what they go to Prague. go to a place that is just east enough, but still safe feeling for Americans.
Yeah.
like that is a perfect choice for the sort of like the beginning to take place, where it's like beautiful and it's scenic and you know it in your head, but it doesn't sound communist. It just sounds foreign. Like it's awesome setting.
The train is England.
Train's in London.
Oh yeah, because they're oh, right. The they channel. Go from Langley to okay, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it's the channel, so it's taking them from London, I would assume, into like Paris or
something. Anything else to say about the first Mission Impossible before we do a Tom Cruise top five?
I'd say it's a very, very interesting movie worth watching at any point.
Yeah, go rewatch it.
Very fun, yeah. Very rewatchable for sure.
Go rewatch it. It's just a joy.
Cool. So yeah, we kind of already had kind of the Tom Cruise discussion to an extent. So what's your fifth favorite Cruise flick? Max, you wanna start?
Mine I didn't really do in like an order, I'll be honest. As per my usual.
Oh.
I like I can't, it's hard for me sometimes to do stuff like that because I don't like it, honestly. My opinion also changes like year to year and whatnot. If I had so in a place that is probably near to five, I went with this Mission Impossible.
Nice.
I went with Mission Impossible 3 is my fifth.
Okay. Yeah, I like that movie. My number five, I'm taking it back to the very beginning. I think it might be his first above the title on the poster, Risky Business, which I think rules. I watched it again last week. I think it's one of those movies that sadly pop culture at large has kind of reduced to like, oh yeah, isn't that some sex comedy where like teen Tom Cruise like slides in and is like it's reduced mostly to old time rock and roll. But great movie, great kind of comic drama that's just like a pretty scathing like indictment of like 80s capitalism / Reagan America. It had an original ending where Rebecca De Mornay is like crying on his shoulder with his same voiceover about my name is like Joe whatever and I deal in human fulfillment, and like that I think would have made the movie all the better. But it's a really good movie as is, and definitely worth checking out for the first time or again if you haven't seen it in a while. Number four. Or another from you, Max?
Yeah, I went with Minority Report. I don't know why history has... I feel like it is getting more and more forgotten. I freaking love it.
I freaking love it.
I love Minority Report. I have a special connection with it because it was a movie my boss made, and so I've seen it a couple of times. It's one of his favorite movies, and yeah.
I came up against that and another movie specifically that'll come up later, and I ended up not including Minority Report because I thought both of you probably would and we'd get to talk about it. But yeah, Minority Report's friggin' awesome.
Yeah, it's badass, man. That like precogs are cool. It came out like it came out before it became played out to do Philip K. Dick stories.
Mm-hmm.
All the Spielbergian stuff is great.
Are you trying to talk some shit about Paycheck now?
You just, even for the writer as prolific as Philip K. Dick, you do run out, and eventually you're like, Philip K. Dick wrote down the sentence kangaroo jail, comma space question mark, and it's like you can't make a movie out of that and call it a Philip K. Dick story.
Philip K. Dick's pay me.
Yeah.
You're
number four. I'm gonna go Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah, really, really cool movie. Yeah.
I love that movie. Could probably be higher if it was, but it, you know, I haven't watched it in a while, but I remember just seeing that in theaters, being struck by how good it was, and I think it might be Cruise's one of his best performances.
Hmm. yeah, it's cool having him play the kind of coward who grows into the hero in that. I feel like that, and maybe to an extent Minority Report, are movies where, like, if Steven Spielberg didn't direct Minority Report and it was just some movie that came from out of nowhere, it would be like on a lot more lists of like, you need to check this movie out. Or like the fact that both are like sort of as mainstream as they are, it like maybe they aren't recognized as much as like if Tom Cruise wasn't in Edge of Tomorrow, not that he's bad in it, like it also would have been like, dude, you need to check this movie out. Which I guess it is for people who haven't seen that, but yeah, that's a good flick. My number four, I'm going with Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. I think it's my favorite of the Mission Impossible movies. I think it just has the best sequences. I mean, you just open with hanging on to the plane as it's taking off. The opera sequence might be the best part of the movie. It's a really cool movie. I think two of the issues in a lot of the Mission Impossible movies, or two of the things that are lacking, are female characters and villains. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman might be the best Mission Impossible villain. I like Sean Harris in Five a lot. He's really creepy. He's got that voice. And Rebecca Ferguson rules in that movie. It's a really fun ride.
Yeah, I don't think it's much of a competition. I think that Philip Seymour Hoffman, it like, there's not a better villain in than that. What he is able to do in that role with just the dialogue, with just like that, you want to talk about a thing to steal for a James Bond movie, a villain like that.
Yeah.
A villain who doesn't, everything that happens without him appearing to raise a hand.
Okay, what's your number three Tom Cruise movie?
My number three. I do this all the time. This is my personal preference.
I'm saying numbers. Okay, it's your personal preference.
Because, for example, in my top
five, we're not building the objective list.
I know, yeah, because in my top five, I do not have Risky Business. I do not have Rain Man. I do not have, you know, Color of Money. I don't have, like, things that are objectively better films than the things I'm going to say. My number three is Jerry Maguire. I love Jerry Maguire. I watch Jerry Maguire a lot. It's a great movie. Show me the money.
Jerry Maguire
is a very young kid.
Better than The Color of Money.
I had it on VHS, and there's a sex scene right at the beginning of it that may or may not have been watched a couple times in Max's VHS player. Very good movie. I've watched that movie probably more than any except for my top two.
Jeremy Wise is great. What's your number three?
Three, I'm gonna go Collateral.
Nice.
Great movie. Amazing movie. Not on my list because I've probably only seen it twice. It's better than my movies.
it's so hard to rank Cruise because he's been in so many movies. But and also too, I kind of left this Mission Impossible movie that we're talking about out of the rankings for now. So
yeah,
you know, this list could change, but this is kind of how I'm feeling.
Yeah, I mean, look, the first Mission Impossible and probably Rain Man should both be in like top five most important Tom Cruise movies, but. This is our personal list. My number three, A Few Good Men. Great Sorkin scripts. Just coming, kind of closing out just a great, great 10-year run for Rob Reiner movies. I think, kind of like Rain Man, it sort of Cruise gets a little... left in the shadow of history, where it's all about Dustin Hoffman and it's all about Jack Nicholson, but he's great in both of those, and he's really given it his all in that court scene with Nicholson and the whole movie. I think great Cruise performance, really entertaining, smart, rewatchable movie. Number twos.
My number two is The Last Samurai. I adore this movie. I love Ken Watanabe. I love Billy Connolly. I was a kid that was obsessed with samurais as a kid. I was a kid that was obsessed with war and stuff. definitely has some Dances with Wolves problems, definitely has some Avatar problems, but like, just a fucking awesome explosive set piece movie slash period piece. It's super fun.
As a kid, I was obsessed with alcoholic Civil War soldiers who had were tormented by their genocides. Yeah, I like The Last Samurai.
I do too.
Actually, kind of similar. Have you guys seen Hidalgo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The horse movie.
Yeah, which I really like. Similar setup for the character, sure. Where there's like this sure. washed up entertainer who was kind of found himself in the middle of like a one of history's terrible genocides.
Yeah. Number two, I didn't want to say too much. You mentioned it earlier. Rain Man is my number two Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah.
He's great in it. He's ridiculously overshadowed by Dustin Hoffman, but the more, if you watch that movie, you realize he's kind of the soul of it, because Dustin Hoffman's playing a character that you can never relate to, where Tom Cruise is playing a character you can absolutely relate to.
Yeah, he's you. And Tom Cruise is playing you in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's playing all of your
But he's the more extreme, life. Yeah. Selfish version of you.
Yeah, like, and I think about the scene where he thinks he's going to bring his brother back and like live with him, and then his brother has that big freak out, and it's like so human. It's such an amazing performance. Tom Cruise's very, very long career, I will say, that is the performance that is the most overshadowed for him. Mm. It's fantastic. He's great in that movie.
Good, weird, but somehow appropriate Zimmer score for that movie. And I think it was Barry Levinson who was talking about how, like, doing the end there and, like, resisting the temptation to have, like, Dustin Hoffman, like, look out and like make eye contact and like smile at him in the train, where it's like, no, this guy would just look away. Like, that's the point is like, and I think that movie kind of socially did a lot of raising awareness. Obviously, also convinced a lot of people that all autistics are savants and can count, you know, count cards and toothpicks and stuff.
There's a really good Bob's Burgers joke about it. Similarly related, with just like a character that people think is autistic, and so they're like, their brother is throwing toothpicks on the ground, and he's like, how many is that? And it's like 100, and they're like, it's two, there are two.
Look, and that's the thing with, he doesn't understand the concept of money, right? Is everything is like, oh, about $100. All autistic people are like Ben Affleck and The Accountant, but they're not like Rain Man.
Yeah,
that's what I've learned from movies.
That's
from
what
movies.
I've also from Hollywood.
You based the entire knowledge, the whole knowledge base is on two movies, The Accountant and Rain Man.
Yeah. And it's more like The Accountant.
Yeah.
My number two is Collateral. I rewatched it over the last couple nights, and it rules. It's one of the best Michael Mann movies. Just a great Hollywood, like, it's kind of him being a director for hire, where it wasn't like his original idea, but he took a script that was, I think, originally gonna be in New York, and at one point Spielberg, Scorsese might have done it, and it makes sense for Scorsese, and Spike Lee was also maybe gonna do it at one point. Michael Mann comes on, moves it to LA. Evil Cruise, Silver Fox Cruise, if you will. it's a really cool movie, and just an unconventional, like, even for the time, it's kind of cool that it got made for the high budget that it did, seeing as it's an action movie with two big movie stars, but there aren't that many per se like action scenes that your huge movie star is an evil murderer, and the slightly less big, the guy who was becoming a huge movie star really that year with that movie and Ray, is kind of a coward for most of the movie. It's a really awesome movie. All right.
Well, that leaves just number one.
Yeah.
Max?
My number one Tom Cruise movie, and I'm realizing I went by how many times I've seen them, which means that this won't be surprising. It's A Few Good Men is my number one.
Hell yeah.
Because there was a time period early in our lives where, like, it was on TV at least once a week.
Yeah,
because it is easy to censor the sort of, like, there's no gratuitous violence, but it's all words. Like, it's violent in the way that an episode of Law and Order is violent, in that they describe horrific things because it's a courtroom drama, but you don't see any of them.
But some of the best, like, sleazy Nicholson lines have to get censored, where he just, what's he, like, you've never lived until you've gotten a blowjob from a superior officer, like, where he's like, oh, I like a woman in charge, like, of course, I'm a general, so I guess I'll have to get blown by a lady president when we get one. It's like, he's so awesome, like, and evil in that.
The script is so great, like, I love all courtroom dramas. I was a kid that grew up reading John Grisham books, religiously. I really dig all that movie. I dig the script. I dig the score. I think, like, although it's simplistic and it's good, it's Mark Shaiman doing some really cool, just sort of, like, you know, like, storytelling through music. I dig that movie.
I think it was on the Rewatchables podcast that they were talking about how Rob Reiner really went kind of Fincher or like Michael Mann for the end there, and like shot that courtroom scene just a ton of times, Nicholson and Cruz yelling at each other, and they like had gotten all they needed from Nicholson, and they maybe gonna do some more of Cruz, but it was mainly like they were gonna get some Kevin Bacon and some like of just like the crowd reaction shots, and they'd said like, all right, like, Jack, you can go home, and Jack Nicholson was like, nah, man, I love acting, and like stuck around and like kept doing the scene like for another hour or two.
Ugh, Kevin Bacon is so good in that. Kiefer Sutherland is so good in that. Kevin Pollak is so good in that.
Yeah,
I love that movie. I love that movie.
You're a lousy fucking softball player, Max. That's
All right. Number one for me is Iron Man. Oh, wait, sorry. Number one for me, Minority Report.
Oh, yeah.
Sick. Sick. Well done. Well done.
It's an awesome movie. It's only gets better with age. I've had the great pleasure of working with someone that worked very closely on it and having been, you know, seen it a bunch of times, just having worked with him. And every time I watch it, it becomes a better and better movie. And it's a kind of masterpiece. And not only because of Cruz, too. I mean, there's scenes... I'd argue maybe one of my top five favorite movie scenes of all time is the Max von Sydow, Colin Farrell showdown scene.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's got so many... It's a movie of moments, and man, the moments are so strong, and Cruz is so good in it. Yeah. And he gives his most epic performance when he watches those videos of his son who has died.
Yeah.
He really gives it. He goes all the way in on it, and he gives, I think, his best performance. And it's got to be number one for me.
Maybe the last great year for Spielberg and John Williams have of that, and Catch Me If You Can, and two great.
Oh.
Just the both of those.
Sorry, the Catch Me If You Can score is unreal. Sorry, I literally had to moan at the concept of that score. It's so good.
Oh, and same with the second you say Minority Report, I'm like playing some of the John Williams music in my head. It's just great and completely different from Catch Me If You Can.
Hey, you're talking to a person with John Williams tattooed on his arm. Like, I'm a fanboy. I ride or die for John Williams.
My number one, I have Jerry Maguire.
Nice.
It's I'm kind of a sap at heart. It's right in that golden period of Cruise. The mid 90s came out I think about 6 months after Mission Impossible. Same with kind of Rain Man. You're using what works about the Cruise movie star charm and him being a little sleazy, where he's playing a character who kind of knows he's full of shit, and it's kind of slowly correcting himself over the movie. It's, I think, easily one of the best scripts that Cruise has had in his career.
I was about to say the same thing.
Just great, you know, Cameron Crowe at the peak of his powers. Just a great kind of pop entertainment.
It's one of those great movies. And this is obviously happening less and less because that's how time works. It's one of those great movies where, like, it is so easy to put it in its own pocket in place because it.
Oh,
it
it's a 90s rom-com or whatever. Niche. Yeah.
No. I'm saying in a positive way where I'm like, how many movies are a dramatic comedy, like
sports movie,
sports movie about an agent? Like it just, it fills such a specific niche.
Yeah.
That like, it's hard to judge it against almost anything else in a way that serves it. Like, that's a reason why we're going to remember it. Look, and I think that there, as we said, if both of them were in my top five, we will remember Jerry Maguire longer and better than we remember Minority Report. Not because one is better than the other, but because one is its own film more than the other.
Right.
No, but I agree. I have no... The toughest thing about ranking a Tom Cruise top five is that there's actually so many diverse, crazy movies. He's had an incredible career when you break it down. And I could absolutely have ranked five different movies in here at any point. And it's a good time to be talking about it. He's about ready to come out with a new movie next week. But he's...
Wait, what's next week?
Maverick. Top Gun Maverick.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen a poster.
Yeah. So, like, he really is incredible.
It's gotten great reviews. Have you seen?
Yeah.
I'm so excited. I am unapologetically, show me the airplane. Show me the airplane go fast. Show me the airplane go fast. Show me the bad mustache on what's his face. Child Goose.
Teller, yeah.
Goose 2.
Baby Goose.
Goose 2. Goose Reloaded.
Yeah, Goose Reloaded.
I'm so excited.
No, he's had an... I mean, there's 15 movies that could be in the top five, you know? I don't know how you really pick.
Just two more points I want to make on Jerry Maguire, where I feel like kind of like Risky Business. It for a lot of people, especially like people who haven't seen those movies, it gets boiled down to like...
Show me the money.
The dancing and... Well, if you're lucky, show me the money, but it's, you know, you had me at hello and you complete me, in a vacuum are very corny. I think they're kind of earned in the movie. I think
human head weighs 8 pounds. That kid kills it.
No, I think even the like objectively corniest stuff works in the context of the movie where it's kind of set up and earned. And it's, you know, kind of the Tom Cruise show. I think it the supporting players that get the most recognized, obviously Cuba Gooding Jr. won an Oscar and made a movie star out of Renee Zellweger. Regina King fucking rules in that movie. Like, you could argue she's the best performance in that. And she's like really incredible. What she does, kind of small role as Rod Tidwell, great character, his wife.
No, it's, you know, the more you dig into Cruise and his whole filmography and what he's done, he's a truly singular force in his career. And
I mean, whether or not he's your favorite, he is our movie star.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Like, he's no one's had the sustained popularity for as many decades, really.
Yeah.
It is a term that gets thrown around a lot nowadays because we live in such a hyper-watched era, where everyone knows what everyone is doing all the time, but he is in that upper echelon of like those people that just as you said, the longevity plus film success. There's a reason why Will Smith didn't get tossed out of the Oscars. It's because Will Smith is a movie star. Like there are very few people that are that level, that creature where I wouldn't be surprised if the next Mission Impossible movie is amazing. I wouldn't be surprised if 3 years from now Will Smith released some movie where he's astounding and it makes, you know, $1 billion. There are very few movie stars in the world.
That pissed me off. I think MI7 was supposed to come out. I mean, it was supposed to come out like 2 years ago, but it was going to be this fall. And then I think it's like a year from right about now. Dead Reckoning Part 1. I'm stoked.
The return of Finkerton, the IMF. Wait, what was his name?
I think you mean Kittredge. You've never seen me Kittredge. Very upset.
Yeah. Thank you.
That was the Kittredge Returns.
I fucking love Kittredge, by the way. Don't talk any shit about it. He's a guy who's really good at doing his job. And like, about when he says everybody has pain points? That's such a good line.
He's the great bureaucrat. He's awesome. He's awesome.
Press on him.
He's also like hamming it up just enough so that you're like, yeah, Tom Cruise and Ving Rhames are realistic in this movie.
That's a really good point. And also, what I hadn't thought about for the new one is that isn't Lea Sado is or one of the female characters is Max's daughter.
Oh yeah. Well, she was in Six. Vanessa. Hold on. White.
Vanessa Kirby.
Vanessa Kirby. Yeah.
She one. Very, very pretty. Two, she's Max's daughter, so you're going to have Kittredge and Max's daughter in the same movie. It's awesome.
Maybe they'll fall in love.
Maybe. A little John. If John Voight has proven that this universe knows nothing about age.
Yeah, that is true.
And at this point, Tom Cruise has proven that too.
Yeah.
Because I cannot stress enough, Tom Cruise is very old for a movie star.
Ethan Hunt is 35.
Yeah, perpetually.
Has been for 20 years.
Yeah. He's like a Simpsons character. You know, time never moves.
Flat circle.
All right, I've got my little bag. Why don't you do the honors and pick the next Bond-related movie that we'll cover on here.
Let's see. What do I?
Maybe
do
it'll
I
be
choose?
What Women Want again.
Pretty Woman.
Oh, it's Boat Trip with Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah.
Sled Dogs with Cuba Gooding Jr.
It's Born.
Okay.
Just, yeah.
Wow.
We don't know what Born yet, but it is Born.
Well, I told you guys. I put. Wow. Well, what I did was I just put this series for because I don't want to like do Born Ultimatum first. Yeah. So we'll do Born Identity next episode.
Wow, I love it.
Austin Powers to Mission Impossible to Born. Is that also almost chronological?
Well, we went 96. We went 97, 96. I think Born Identities like 02.
Yeah, 02.
Well, I haven't seen it in a minute. He's gonna do the cool car disappearance. You love that.
I will just ask, and there's only one answer for this. Is the original Mission Impossible the best non-Bond movie that's a Bond movie ever? And if you don't say yes, I'm going to be very upset because it is. It's a Bond movie. It's a spy thriller. It takes place on trains.
You and I both agreed that it's not even our favorite Mission Impossible movie, so...
That's true, but it is the best Bond replica.
I don't, because I have to say it's Austin Powers.
Damn it, Max. Damn it.
Austin Powers is a nearly perfect movie that is a Bond movie.
You're right, and you're ruining this for us.
I'm so sorry, because I want to be there for you. I love Mission Impossible, and I think that it is a perfect heist film, a perfect spy film. But Austin Powers is one of the... On rewatching it, it's one of the funniest fucking movies ever made.
Fair enough.
Who throws a shoe? Honestly.
All right. Well, thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you soon with a discussion on the Bourne Identity.
Yeah. Fantastic.